Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next on This Week in Law, Ben Weisner from the ACLU is our guest. He heads the Speech Privacy and Technology Project there. And with him, we're going to discuss the new travel ban imposed by executive order and the ACLU's efforts in combating it. We're going to talk about campus speech, whistleblowers, and Edward Snowden, Neil Gorsuch, the new Supreme Court nominee, and copyrighted cakes. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 375, recorded February 3rd, 2017, Making Lawyers Sexy Again. Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I am so excited that you've picked this week to join us because we have just an amazing roster of topics and a really, really interesting, fun, intelligent, hardworking, we're so grateful to have him guest. He has been on the TWiT Network before, and if you have not yet caught episode 268 of Triangulation with Leo Laporte, I encourage you to also watch that because that was Ben's first appearance with us. Ben Weisner from the ACLU is here with us today. He is the director of the ACLU's Technology, Privacy, and Speech Project. I got that wrong. Speech, Privacy, and Technology in that order project. He's been at the ACLU for many, many years and is also quite well known as Edward Snowden's lawyer. So we're so excited to have you back on the network, Ben. Thanks so much for making the time for us.
Thank you.
Although I'm sure you probably didn't have to do anything to make time for us. Nothing's going on at the ACLU this week, right?
Everyone is walking around like sleep-deprived zombies now. It's been an incredible 7 days since last Friday afternoon.
Yes, oh, I'm sure.
It's only been 7 days.
You know?
Wow. I'm sure that it has. Also with me here are my two wonderful co-hosts, Emery Roan, 3L at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Great to see you again, Emery.
And you as well, Denise, chat, listeners. Ben, thanks for joining us. I am super excited about today's show.
And Mike Keyes up at the Dorsey Firm in Seattle, Washington, where he is a partner and one of the co-authors of their wonderful blog, The TMCA. Great to see you again, Mike.
As always, a great pleasure to be here, Denise, and especially with Emery and our special guest, Ben. Super excited about today's show.
Yeah, me too.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. So our first topic, and just for anyone who's wondering and is a regular watcher of the show and is really in love with our bumpers, we're going to skip bumpers this week. There aren't going to be any bumpers between our topics because we're going to be bouncing back and forth quite a bit. And I don't want to over bumper you all. So we're just going to launch right into some legislation, policy, Washington, D.C. oriented topics. And the first one is going to be the travel ban that we were alluding to that has been keeping the ACLU on its toes for the last week. Ben, we should probably have you sort of bring folks up to speed. We have great resources in our rundown for this week. If folks want more to read on the topic, those are available for you at tagpacker.com/users/thisweekinlaw, episode 375 we're on right now. One of those resources attempted to run down all the airport cases that have been filed throughout the country and what is at stake in them. But this is very much a moving target. So maybe you could help us, you know, as we speak here at this moment, let us know where things stand on the executive order banning travel from 7 specified countries and banning all travel. Well, we can pick that apart a little bit too, and banning refugees as well. As far as the lawsuits go, where do things stand?
Yeah, I hesitate to even try to freeze a moment in time because I'm sure that somewhere in the country right now, some of my ACLU colleagues are in a court hearing, either in Virginia or in Los Angeles or in New York, and the situation is extremely fluid. I imagine anybody who's watching this has been following the news over the last week. And last Friday afternoon, President Trump signed an executive order that froze all refugee resettlement in the United States, banned nationals from seven countries for coming in for 90 days, although the rumors out of the administration have been that that's just the first 90 days, it's going to be extended indefinitely, and really created chaos because thousands of people were in transit, people were detained at airports, people were turned away. The ACLU tried to contact administration officials to find out who the order applied to and who it didn't. They either weren't organized enough to answer the phone or decided not to. And the result was a team of lawyers stayed up all night on Friday night, filed the first federal lawsuit in Brooklyn federal court on Saturday morning. And there was already a hearing in court that Saturday night. Meanwhile, there was just an extraordinary spontaneous outpouring and uprising across the country. So you saw grassroots protests at airports, but also hundreds of lawyers fanning out to these airports to talk to family members, to try to reach the refugees, to file emergency habeas corpus petitions. Before the end of the night, we had orders from different federal courts that unanimously said that there was a likelihood that the ban would be found to violate the Constitution, and therefore the courts ordered injunctions preventing the government from removing or deporting any of the people who were in transit, in some cases ordering that they be let out of detention and into the United States. Since then, many other legal actions have been filed in different courts to the point where it's difficult to keep track of all of them. So again, it's a fluid situation, but so far every court that looked at this has found that the plaintiffs in these cases have shown a likelihood of success on the merits in holding that these orders will prove to be unconstitutional. I imagine you could make this a subject on your show every week for 5 minutes and there would be some serious significant updates to share.
Right. Let's parse out some of the plaintiffs and their positions, if we could. We have people who have who are not U.S. citizens. First of all, are U.S. Let's start with U.S. citizens.
That's a good idea. So we'll work down. So no one who's a U.S. citizen should be affected by this. So that's something that I can state pretty unequivocally. There's nothing in this order that would purport to apply to any U.S. citizen. The next category
stop you there for a second though?
Sure.
What if they're dual citizens of one of the seven countries?
Mm-hmm. If you're a U.S. citizen, then the government has no basis from preventing you from returning to the United States without violating the Constitution. And I've not heard of a single case where a dual citizen, where one half of that is the United States, has been turned away. If you're traveling on a U.S. passport as a U.S. citizen, these orders should not affect you. And if anybody has heard of a case where that has happened, please call the ACLU 5 minutes ago.
Right. Okay.
The second category where there's been a fair amount of confusion coming out of the administration has been people who have green cards, who are lawful permanent residents of the United States, but citizens of another country. Our understanding is that when the order was drafted, the Department of Homeland Security asked the White House for clarification to say, surely this isn't intended to apply to green card holders. And the White House instructed DHS that on the contrary, it was, which created, again, more chaos. There were people who were lawful U.S. residents who were detained in airports. We heard stories about green card holders who were coerced at the airport into signing away their legal residency so that they wouldn't be detained. It's now clear in the litigation. So Judge Brinkema in the Eastern District of Virginia, issued a sweeping order, an injunction against enforcing this against green card holders anywhere in the country. And we've heard since then that the administration has backed off from that position. They now agree that if you have a green card, if you're a lawful resident of the United States, then these bans should not apply to you.
Okay,
so we're dealing with different categories, right?
Than those. If you don't have a green card, you might have a valid immigration visa.
That's right. And if you might have a valid immigration visa, we heard in one of the hearings today that was held in Virginia, the judge asked the government to estimate how many visas had been affected by these orders, and the Department of Justice lawyer said that more than 100,000 visas have been canceled as a result of this order. This could apply to people who have a visa that allows them to work or to study in the United States. We've heard a huge number of complaints from universities, and 47 leading university presidents today wrote to the president saying that this has, again, created huge disruption at universities, has prevented students from being able to come here, has prevented faculty from being able to come here, and graduate students. And I think what we're going to see before long is that there will be no international academic conference or other kinds of conferences that will be held here. Another letter being prepared this week is from the major technology companies, Apple, Google, and the others, who object, of course, because many of their high-skilled workers are nationals of other countries. But I was glad to see that those tech companies didn't just write in self-interest. They also included that this country has long been compassionate towards refugees, and that even that part of the ban, which may not affect Apple or Google as much as, say, H-1B visas, is still highly objectionable to those companies. So we are seeing resistance that goes beyond the street protests. It's going to begin to create serious problems for corporations, for universities, for any kinds of global entities where people travel across borders. One very complex part of this has to do with dual nationals where neither country is from the United States. I had read that the immigration minister of Canada, a member of the Canadian cabinet, is Somali-born. And as someone who is from one of the seven countries, it was unclear whether a senior Canadian government official would be allowed to cross the border to come to a meeting in the United States. And, this shows just how crude, how cruel, how overbroad, how sloppy this order really was.
So we have various cases in various courts. And as you say, there may be more being filed as we sit here speaking today, poking injunctive holes, putting various fingers in the dike of the order. And in a moment, we'll get to talking about a lawsuit that challenges the order as a whole out of the state of Washington. But what I want to get to about all of those lawsuits is the constitutional basis for them. And I think it's really interesting for folks to go back and listen to the episode of Triangulation that you did with Leo, where the two of you got into a conversation about your work on the no-fly list cases and the constitutional basis for providing non-U.S. citizens with protection vis-a-vis travel. How is that going to play out here, Ben?
It's a good question. I think that the legal issues that you're seeing litigated in these early injunctive proceedings are not necessarily the same ones that are going to be central as the litigation plays out over time. And here's what I mean by that. I think that the core objection to this order is based on religious discrimination. We believe that it's very clear, not just from the text of the order, but from all the statements that the president and government officials have made around it, that the intent was to exclude Muslims. Our view is that that's a violation of the Establishment Clause when the government itself decides to discriminate against people on the basis of religion, even if the individuals at issue may not themselves have standing to raise a constitutional claim in their own right because they're non-citizens abroad. That's not the issue that's played out the most in the, you know, in these early habeas actions for people who were detained, mm-hmm. where the claims are based on equal protection, are based on due process, and really based on the standard for injunctions, about the irreparable harm that will be caused to these people if they're sent away, and the lack of the government's ability to show any harm by putting a stay on it. So I should point out for readers who aren't lawyers that that getting these preliminary injunctions or these temporary restraining orders is really a statement from the court that we think you've raised at least a plausible constitutional claim. We think that you showed that you the standard is a likelihood to prevail. But when we're talking about these hearings that take place in the first 24 hours, there's usually not a reasoned legal analysis. What the court is really looking at is who's going to be harmed more if we don't hit pause. And in all of these cases, the judges were saying the government has no claim whatsoever that will be harmed by hitting pause. However, refugees being sent back into harm's way is the very definition of irreparable harm.
Right. And constitutionally, we're working toward an interesting juncture there, in that many of these courts have issued orders staying enforcement of the executive order, and those orders aren't necessarily being complied with. So the next step in the legal process then is to hold in contempt the people who are not complying with the district court's injunctive relief orders.
It might be. Depending on the quantity and quality of the evidence that we're able to compile about that, there could be contempt motions in the courts. I think my colleagues have had a fair amount of success in resolving a lot of those individual situations. So I've heard different things over the course of the week about whether or when a contempt motion would be filed. I think what happened yesterday in New York was that there was a status conference where the government was asked to respond to questions from the court. Something similar in Virginia today, but certainly, there's almost nothing more serious in our legal system than a party to a lawsuit disobeying an order from a court. And if there's evidence that that's happening on any kind of systemic basis, it's not going to go well for the Trump administration.
Right. So we are talking about the individual lawsuits relating to individual travelers. And I alluded to the fact that there is a lawsuit pending from the state of Washington. There may be others that are filed as well, challenging the order as a whole. Mike, since you're up in that neck of the woods, I'm wondering if this is something that's more based on injury to business interests in the state of Washington, including parties like Amazon, Microsoft, and Expedia. Am I right about that?
That's correct. It looks as though the allegations in that complaint are that businesses are being affected. The economy here in Washington is being affected. Certainly Amazon and Expedia have been very vocal in their support of the lawsuit. And I believe both of them have now joined in the lawsuit as named plaintiffs. There's a variety of causes of action here that are alleged against the Trump administration and the various governmental officials, ultimately seeking injunctive relief and a ruling that large portions of this executive order are unconstitutional.
Ben, are you aware of any other non-targeted, take out the whole order focused lawsuits?
Yes, and so some of this is swimming around in my brain, and so I don't know whether this is one of the cases that we've talked about or still another one. But I am aware that there was a putative class action filed on behalf of people who are already in the United States but will be prevented by executive orders from being able to achieve legal lawful permanent residence. So people who are here and who would otherwise qualify to be able to apply for green cards but are being prevented even from initiating that because of their national origin have moved to challenge that as well. And I'm sure that we're not being comprehensive and that there are plenty of others.
Right. How about this notion of an injury to your constitutionally protected right to employ yourself, to pursue your business interests with some freedom from government restrictions. That seems to be where the Washington case is going, and I'm assuming that various individuals might want to make that assertion as well.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that one? I haven't had a chance to look at those pleadings or to consider that angle.
No, I was hoping forward to
Just something to toss out there. Something I think we might see coming down the pipe as well. Who knows? One thing that we may see coming that I wanted to get your take on, Ben, was reported by Jake Tapper at CNN. CNN was told by sources that White House Policy Director Stephen Miller noted that the administration officials are discussing the possibility of asking foreign visitors to disclose all websites. This is, it says asking foreign visitors. So we don't know whether this is within the parameters of this travel and refugee ban, or if we're talking about every foreign visitor to the United States. This is nothing that's been implemented yet. It's just under discussion. Asking them to disclose all websites and social media sites they visit and to share the contacts in their cell phones. If the foreign visitor declines to share such information, he or she could be denied entry. The social media posts calling for jihad by San Bernardino terrorist Tashfeen Malik, made under a pseudonym and with strict privacy settings, are part of this discussion. How such a policy would be implemented remains under discussion, so reported CNN. What do you think about that in your capacity as director of the speech technology and privacy project at the ACLU, Ben?
So for this, we should be clear that this conversation did not start with the Trump administration. It didn't start in the last week. This is an idea that's been bouncing around government circles, at least since San Bernardino, when President Obama was president, and probably before. You know, it strikes me as both a chilling kind of policy and in remarkably ineffective kind of policy. In the specific case of the San Bernardino case, it's unlikely that it would have led to any changes. But once you announce a policy like this, anyone who is trying to enter the country to actually do harm would be the one who would be sort of most careful about communications and about social media policy. And it's everyone else who will be swept in. I should tell you, a colleague of mine at the ACLU, who was a non-citizen, was stopped at the border yesterday and asked a series of inappropriate ideological questions. Why would someone who works for an organization called the American Civil Liberties Union have a foreign passport? Why would you be traveling overseas? What kind of conferences do you speak at? What's the subject? Are you talking about what kind of law are you talking about? What we've seen is that the executive order and the kind of vibe that's coming from the White House has unleashed a workforce that is full of people who are very comfortable aggressively and inappropriately questioning travelers. And if your passport is from Pakistan, even though that isn't one of the seven countries that's on the list, you're going to be grilled about that. You know, the idea that we're going to be opening up the Facebook accounts and address books of everybody who comes here is, to me, it's fundamentally un-American. Whether there is a constitutional or legal challenge that can be mounted against that, or whether this is really just a question of wise and humane policy, I don't know yet.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is where do you begin to mount that legal challenge?
I think it would be difficult. I think again, it depends. So if you're talking about U.S. citizens, obviously the Constitution comes into play. And any border search, although the government has more latitude to do searches at the border than it would in other places, still has to be reasonable under the Constitution. I would say the same about a lawful permanent resident who would also have constitutional rights. If you're talking about people who don't themselves have constitutional rights, so this would be non-citizens who don't have permanent ties to the country and who are still outside the border, you might think about it more in terms of the rights of Americans to hear their ideas. If something like this, has the effect of preventing people from traveling to the United States who might have dissident views or, you know, views that would cause them to be flagged by border patrol agents, even if they have nothing to do with terrorism. And we've seen this with every kind of exclusion rule, that people are routinely excluded on the basis of ideology and not danger. Then it might be possible to raise a claim that the rights of Americans to hear that speech is being compromised by the ideology-based exclusion. Apart from that, it could be difficult to mount a legal challenge.
Another area that is near and dear to the technology industry's heart, and again is under discussion for change with the current administration, is the H-1B visa program. All we seem to know, again, nothing, no executive order has issued, but we do know that talks are ongoing, and what we've heard from the White House is that if changes were made to the visa program, businesses would have to try to hire American first. If they recruit foreign workers, priority would be given to the most highly paid, according to a report from Bloomberg. Do you see any sort of constitutional difficulties there, or is this just a tinkering with a visa program that the administration would have legal discretion to do?
They might very well. You know, I think in this instance, there are very powerful political stakeholders who will be able to raise the concerns of that class of workers in a way that won't, you know, require the ACLU necessarily to play the same kind of role that we do with refugees. I do think that American businesses that are not really American businesses, they're global businesses that really rely on being able to attract talented people from everywhere, are going to raise serious objections. I think there are people in the Trump administration who are probably quite sensitive to those objections, even though there are others who surely are not. And my guess is that it's more likely that that will play out politically rather than legally.
Got it. Okay, I think that's about all I've got on the travel ban and travel issues, other than just to ask you, Ben, and I do want to see if Mike and Emery have any follow-up questions, but I do want to ask you, Ben, I'm sure there are folks listening to the show who would like to be of assistance if they can. I personally know lawyers who are, let's just put it this way, not only are lawyers more sexy than they have been in a long time, but immigration lawyers in particular. Yeah, feeling the love. And I've seen, you know, a number of opportunities for people who are not trained in that area to get more training in that area so that they can also position themselves to help out. Would you think that's the most effective thing to do, or let the experts at the ACLU handle this and support them financially?
You know, obviously in the last 7 days in particular, we've been overwhelmed by offers of volunteer pro bono legal assistance sort of across the board, from individual practitioners to the biggest law firms in the United States. And it's hard even to keep up with all of those offers coming in now. I would say the best thing for lawyers who are listening to do, who want to be more involved with the ACLU, is to reach out locally, not to the national office in New York, but to whatever the local ACLU affiliate is where you live, which, you know, in most states, we just have one affiliate. In California, we have offices in San Francisco, San Diego, and Los Angeles, and they'll be in the best position to be able to help mobilize volunteer or pro bono support in the community. One thing that we're going to have to do as an organization is find better ways to mobilize volunteer energy among people who are not lawyers. And, you know, in the first 100 years of our existence, we haven't been set up to harness that kind of grassroots energy and support. But we're talking about hiring a national volunteer coordinator so that we can, you know, do more with all of the incredible outpouring of support that we've been receiving.
Okay, Mike, anything you want to add or probe before we move on?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, I think I've got a great title for today's show, Making Lawyers Sexy Again. That was number one.
Sold. Sold. Yeah.
Ben, so I wonder if you could look into your crystal ball for just a moment here and give us a little bit of understanding as to how this is probably going to play out with these orders. As a result of the injunctions being entered, I believe there'd be an automatic immediate right of appeal by the government officials that are being restrained. that will go to the appellate court level. And then do you see this ultimately playing out at the Supreme Court soon?
Well, I think the only way that it would not play out in the Supreme Court would be if the government accepts its sort of across the board losses in these cases and revises the rules or the executive order. That doesn't really seem like the style of this administration, which has already fired one deputy attorney general acting as acting attorney general because she wasn't willing to defend these orders. So, I think it's quite likely that the constitutionality of these kinds of restrictions will find its way to the Supreme Court. And whether it gets there before the Ninth Justice or not is something that's hard to say.
Fascinating.
Emery, anything you want to add or ask about?
No, I mean, I think that both of your questions have hit on all the important points. I'm watching this as someone that is married to a non-American and who, you know, we've been going through the green card process over the past few year and a half now, and we just got our green card. It's super exciting, but this is all very painful. It's hard to watch. The idea that, if my wife happened to be from, 100 miles south of where she was from, then, the already painful experiences that we had at the airport. When you talk, by the way, about your peer that was, inappropriately questioned about, why if you have an ACLU, if you're American Civil Liberties Union, why? My wife, who, by the way, at the time was donating 20 hours a week to nonprofits to, pro bono hours at the clinics to help women that were abused. At the same time as she was, studying for the bar that she just finished working through the LLM, when we were coming back from Italy, she was pulled into the green room while I was told to sit for 2 hours downstairs in the baggage claim while they asked her, why are you studying the bar? What are you doing? What are you doing in America studying the bar? It's just
Well, it's tough not to hear
alarmist.
I think I see the protests of last weekend and the legal actions as being very related to each other. That we like to think that courts sit outside of majoritarian political impulses and processes. Our federal judges get life tenure. They're supposed to be insulated from the pressures and political atmosphere around them. We all know that's not true. And that, the fact that hundreds of thousands of people sort of spontaneously rushed to airports, that the courts themselves were packed and there were crowds outside chanting, created the atmosphere in which these four federal judges issued their injunctions last weekend, and will create the atmosphere in which the Supreme Court ultimately decides this. We've seen that several of the justices on the Supreme Court are very attuned to where the public is and don't want to be too far ahead or too far behind where the public is. So I think it's going to be really important for people, and this is something that surely no law degree is necessary for, to find public and vocal ways to show their opposition to these policies.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if there ever was a way to mobilize a bunch of people, it's go straight to the family. This is stopping people from being with their loved ones. This is literally stop, tearing families apart, in effect, exiling people from coming back to America or, capturing people and refusing to let them go back home. Seems bad strategy from the Trump administration.
All right. Well, from protests at the airport to protests at my alma mater, UC Berkeley, where I attended law school, let's move from travel to speech and talk about what happened Wednesday night when Milo Yiannopoulos was scheduled to speak at UC Berkeley. Milo, you may recall, if you're a regular listener to the show, is someone we discussed back in July of last year when he was banned from Twitter and permanently suspended from having a Twitter account because of, actually, it's hard to say why exactly he was banned. Twitter doesn't give people that information when they permanently suspend them. But you can read the tea leaves and read the tweets and know that Milo Yiannopoulos was engaged in some offensive, borderline harassing activity on Twitter. And aside from the things he tweeted himself, I think was suspected of having organized others to come after people like Leslie Jones in very offensive ways. So aside from the fact that maybe his own tweets, which were enough to get him suspended, apparently were bad, there was other activity that was going on sort of at his urging or behest or in an effort perhaps to curry favor with or support him that people didn't like either. So he's a highly controversial speaker and writer. I believe he's an editor as well at Breitbart. And between last summer and now, he has been on a college campus tour that the Berkeley incident was the latest culmination of. That has been getting more and more heated as it has gone on. Last June, I believe it was, he spoke at UC Irvine down here in Southern California, and only 15 people turned out to protest, and they were given pacifiers by the campus Republicans who had arranged for Milo to come speak. So it was a slightly different scenario playing out than hundreds of people and outside instigators coming in as well, and flame and damaged property and everything else that we saw on Wednesday night. So with Ben here, I wanted the opportunity. I wanted to remind folks, if you remember our discussion about Milo Yiannopoulos getting suspended from Twitter, the different standards apply to private entities such as Twitter or Facebook where speech takes place than would to a public university like the University of California that receives state and federal funding and in that sense is considered a government actor for speech purposes. The First Amendment applies in the latter case, doesn't apply directly anyway in the former. So UC Berkeley has come under fire, not to make a pun of what happened there on Wednesday night. About the whole event, it's come under fire in many ways. First of all, it came under fire for allowing this person on campus to speak. Secondly, it came under fire for, once having allowed that, not doing enough, perhaps, to make sure that things did not devolve into the mayhem that we saw on Wednesday night. So, Ben, I wanted to get your take on speech on college campuses. We were discussing new incoming FCC chairman Ajit Pai, who, among many others, thinks that the situation has devolved to the point where if you're a conservative speaker on a college campus, you don't have speech rights, that you're shouted down and not protected. Why don't we start with whether you think the university did everything that it needed to and how that differs from the Twitter situation that we saw last summer?
Okay, well, I think that one of the misconceptions about this incident is that some people believe that the university itself invited him to speak there, and that, I've heard people say, regardless of what you think about the First Amendment, they shouldn't have invited him. That's not really what happened. A student group, the College Republicans, invited him, and the question for the university was very much a legal one, which is, could they prevent the College Republicans from having a speaker on campus on the basis of his extreme offensive political views? And in my view, that wasn't a terribly difficult legal question for a public university. Surely it's established that a university cannot prevent a speaker on the basis of viewpoint. Now, they can protect students from unlawful conduct. And if Milo or someone like him used the venue in order to cross the line into genuine incitement targeted at individual or groups, the law wouldn't protect him. But that's a different question than the one that the university faced up front, where the question was, should they prevent a speaker from coming to speak at all? So I think, you know, on that, I think what the university did was exactly right. What then happened was that violent protesters who broke the law created a disruptive environment where the speech could not take place. Now, I don't know the facts well enough to know whether the university could have done more to prevent those kinds of protests from being as disruptive as possible. But I don't see how the university can be blamed for the illegal actions of a handful of people who set fires and committed vandalism. You know, what followed, of course, was the president threatening over Twitter to cut off federal funding to the university because Milo wasn't allowed to speak. And the idea that you would penalize a 38,000 student university for the criminal activity of a handful of people in preventing a speaker after the university had in fact attempted to provide a forum, you know, is beyond absurd. But we don't expect constitutional analysis from the president on Twitter, just an emotional reaction to it. So that part of it seems, you know, fairly straightforward. You know, as to the question of Twitter kicking him off, it raises very important policy questions, but not necessarily difficult legal questions. As you said, Twitter is a private company, which means that it's not bound by the First Amendment. Having said that, we need to acknowledge that over the last decade or so, these privately owned online platforms have become the 21st century public square. And so Twitter and Facebook and others are the places where people go, where in the past you might have gone to the town green. To that end, I think they have obligations. They have responsibility. They should promote the values of free speech, even if they're not bound by the legal restrictions of an entity that is bound by the First Amendment. But we also have to acknowledge that Twitter itself has its own right under the First Amendment to define the kind of online political community that it wants to have. And if it wants to have a community that is free from the kinds of harassment that Milo was involved in, I never followed him and didn't pay close attention to specifically what he was doing, then Twitter has that right to say, this is the kind of community we're going to be. We're going to be a community where there's no explicit sexual content, where there is no harassment directed at other members of the community in a particular way. What I would say is that if they're going to have policies like those, they need to make sure that they're applied fairly and consistently, that people have some kind of due process that the company creates so that people don't get kicked off arbitrarily. Because, again, if you're going to set yourself up as this 21st century public square, as a place where you want the important political debates of the day to take place, I think you have an obligation to promote the values of free expression even where the law doesn't require it.
Do you think that the law may evolve to we were talking before the show about a California Supreme Court case where private property owners have to make speech zones available. And I'm wondering if you think we could head that direction in the case of social media private entities.
So offline, if you could imagine a town in which there was no public land, but all land was private. So instead of having a town green, it's just mall after mall after mall after mall. You might say the law has to be accommodated to create a kind of limited public forum on some of that private land. Otherwise, there would be no place where speech could take place. Will something happen like that in social media and online platforms? I think we're at the stage where people are writing law review articles along those lines. I don't think we're yet at the stage where the courts are going to grapple with that. And as I said before, the First Amendment issues in a case like that might very well be on both sides, because you know, a Twitter or a Facebook or a Snapchat might have a very powerful expressive interest in being a particular kind of forum, and not wanting to open itself up to everyone just because it opens itself up to some. And that right would have to be weighed against the sort of communal need to have these forums be fair ones.
So I want to segue now into talking about your possibly most famous client, Edward Snowden. And on the way, I wanted to mention an article from Politico this week that discussed last week, if folks recall or listened, we did a show that talked a lot about federal employees with alt Twitter accounts or manning official Twitter accounts in ways that perhaps were not authorized or approved of. And this Politico article follows up on that and talks about various government employees starting to use private technologies at their disposal, like WhatsApp and Signal, to communicate with one another in an encrypted way, and to have their own sort of back channel. And here's a quote from the article, an employee discussing that the goal is to create a network across the agency of people who will raise red flags if Trump's appointees do anything unlawful. So, Ben, I wanted to get your take on the speech ramifications of encryption, I guess, and how what we're seeing here begins to relate to what happened with your client, Mr. Snowden.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's an irony here because a lot of the secure communications tools that we use, some of the prominent ones, were actually developed inside the U.S. military to allow dissidents overseas to communicate securely in hostile authoritarian environments. So the Tor project, which is associated with sort of radical tech elements here, was in fact developed by the Navy and promoted around the world by the State Department so that dissidents in China or Iran or other places could communicate securely. Now we're seeing the migration of that need into our own government because of the authoritarian tendencies that are sort of pushing down from the top. Look, I think that what the Trump administration is going to realize is that you can't put a lid on a multi-million member federal workforce. And the tighter they try to screw this, that lid down, the more other channels are going to develop for people to get the word out. We've never seen a leakier administration in the history of this country than what we've seen over the last 2 weeks, where there are leaks coming from every agency, and including the Oval Office. And so information will have a way to come out. That doesn't mean that there won't be a very punitive environment within the agencies, and it's a welcome sign that there are now readily available tools like Signal and WhatsApp that people can use to have secure communications. One word of caution to people out there who may be relying on these tools is that, Signal will protect the content of your communication against any attempt to intercept or wiretap. It won't protect the metadata. And so I don't know about the wisdom of people at an agency saying they're setting up a underground cell within that agency to communicate information around, because the government would be able to, with the right legal authority, to look at the metadata of those communications and see who's communicating with whom, even if they can't see the content of them. So these solutions aren't perfect. Related to this, we're lucky that Snowden came around when he did in 2013. You know, the first thing that he said in that first interview in The Guardian, where he introduced himself, was that part of his motivation was his concern that we might get a different kind of leader someday, one who had less respect for democratic norms, one who would take the architecture of surveillance that had been built and turn it inward against the American people, and that if all we had were a bunch of rules, those rules could be swept aside. Well, in the 3.5 years between Snowden's emergence and Trump's ascension, we saw the much more widespread development of encryption across platforms, tools like Signal. So now we're sort of encountering this new threat environment with a lot more weapons of resistance.
Okay, so let's talk about what's going on with Edward Snowden currently. The campaign for a pardon was not successful. He is in Russia through 2020, and then has to find alternate residency. So
maybe.
I maybe.
Well, I mean, you know, he has the equivalent of a green card there, which is instead of being permanent, it's renewable every 3 years. So this is the second time that he's been extended, 3 years to live there. It's not asylum, actually. He's able to travel and work lawfully there. So, he made clear from the beginning that his first choice would be able to come home, but he would not come home in a way that would serve as a deterrent to future whistleblowers. He wasn't going to get crushed by a legal system that would give him a 30 or 50 year sentence for what he thought was an act of conscience and what turned out to be a critical piece of reform. There was no reasonable offer ever offered by the United States government of a deal that he could even consider accepting. He applied for asylum, as you know, in 24 countries or more when he was stuck in the airport in Russia. He would still very much like to be able to have option three. Right now, option one is Russia. Option two is a maximum security cell in the United States. So if another country were able to offer him option three, I think he would strongly consider it or take it. But, you know, having said that, this is also a show about technology. Mm-hmm. Technology has taken some of the sting out of exile. It does that by allowing easy communication between friends and family, using technology like what we're using right now and other things. It allows Edward Snowden in 2016 to do 50 public appearances by video technology around the world. And already he's been doing many this year. So the government has been able to keep him out of the country, but it hasn't been able to keep his message or his voice out of the country. And if he ends up having to stay in Russia longer, I'll say this. When he undertook to do what he did, he expected much worse. He didn't expect that he would be able to be a vital part of the debate that he helped launch. He thought that it was overwhelmingly likely that he would be captured and imprisoned. The fact that he's able to live this, you know, rich and fulfilling life using technology is beyond his expectations, and he's definitely not asking for pity.
Got it. That's good to know. There is a piece in our discussion points that he didn't have the benefit of your advice, Ben, as he was making decisions and taking actions. And there is a piece that highlights how difficult it would have been and must have been for him to figure out what his rights were in connections with the actions that he took, a piece from the Washington Post discussing the law that may or may not have offered him any cover. It's a complicated and open to interpretation kind of question.
Well, actually, it's not so complicated in this case. What whistleblower law provides can in fact be an arcane and complicated question. In his case, though, there's no legal regime that could have offered him protection. He was not trying to report an isolated incident of fraud or misconduct or illegality that was unknown to his superiors or to Congress. He was objecting to an entire surveillance regime that had been approved by all three branches of government without the consultation of the American people. And so there's no place to go to say, I need to complain about a program that the president has ordered, that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has authorized, and that has been briefed to the Intelligence Committees of the House and Senate. The only place to go in that circumstance is to the public through the media. He did it in the most cautious and responsible way he could. He didn't publish the documents himself. He didn't give them in bulk to an entity that would publish them in bulk. He gave them to news institutions that are very cautious about what they publish.
Can we talk about that real quick?
Yeah,
sorry.
Sure.
I just wanted to. So when Chelsea's clemency was brought up when it broke a few weeks ago, and we talked about this, I characterized my opinion on the differences and the similarities between the two whistleblowers, and I think that rubbed the wrong way against at least one of our listeners who wrote us. I guess I'd love to hear your take, if you could compare and characterize the way that Chelsea Manning, leaked her documents and the way that Ed Snowden leaked his documents, and which, if either, sort of followed the ideal whistleblower track and ways that the whistleblower protection, I guess, inevitably would have failed either or both of them.
Well, again, right. I think
before you answer that, I have a follow up.
Sure.
To draw everything to a close, if you have any advice for folks who find themselves in this situation, you know, who should they speak to and how should they proceed?
Well, so I think you need to, first of all, divide whistleblowers into two categories. Put most federal workers on one side and then put so-called national security employees on the other. And the protections in the latter category have always been inadequate and weak. The law doesn't extend as much protection to them. And even in cases where the law does extend protection, it's so difficult to prevent retaliation, given how easy it is for government to withdraw security clearance, even if they don't bring a case. If they withdraw your security clearance, they've basically ended your ability to be employed in your field. Millions of people rely on that security clearance in order to be employed in the national security world. And so there are not a lot of great options for national security whistleblowers. I would urge, though, people in government to turn to the organizations, the Government Accountability Project, the Project on Government Oversight, that have expertise in the very sort of detailed arcane procedures that are available to other federal workers. You know, the instructions that went out to federal workers imposing gags were inaccurate in the sense that they did not include the exception for illegal conduct. Illegal government activity can always be reported through proper channels again, and you ought to be able to do that without retaliation. But on the national security side, it doesn't always turn out that way. You know, the ACLU represents both Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. And so I don't think I'm going to be the person who's going to assign different moral categories here.
Right, of course.
In this case, I think people have the information they need in order to reach the conclusions that they want to reach about what the the proper way is to act if you encounter grave misconduct as they did.
And so, as far as resources for those kinds of people, would you, aside from just the ACLU, what government agencies should they be looking to for support?
Well, there's OSCE, which is you could go to osce.gov, and I think federal workers would know this. Many federal workers can turn to their unions for advice about how to proceed in these kinds of situations. The expert organizations in Washington are the Government Accountability Project, GAP, and the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, which have great online resources that people can turn to for advice in these situations.
Great.
And look,
thank you.
Let me, on a closing note, say this. I think there are probably people out there who may not have been enthusiastic about Chelsea Manning or about Edward Snowden, who are going to want to take a second look at this whistleblower question and are going to realize over the next few years, when all three branches of government are under the control of one party, when traditional oversight mechanisms probably won't work so well, that we're going to be relying on whistleblowers and a free press in order to protect our institutions. So I hope people, again, who may have been hostile to a Manning or a Snowden before, will understand now, have a new appreciation for the value of what they did.
Ben, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us today. We know that you have much to do, and we're going to let you get back to doing it. Thank you for that final bit of knowledge and resource that you imparted. Is there anything else that you want to let our listeners and viewers know about before you go ahead and sign off with us for the day?
I always have said in the past, I never will miss the opportunity to tell people to join the ACLU. I feel a little sheepish doing that now because so many hundreds of thousands of people have done that over the last week. But it really still is important to us. More than your money, your numbers. If you agree with our positions, don't be a passive supporter, be an active supporter, even if it's only $20 a year that you're contributing. It builds our power to have a bigger base. And so please join us at ACLU.org. Thanks so much.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben.
And
we hope to have the opportunity to chat with you again sometime
in
the future.
All right. Absolutely. Enjoy your
Thank
day.
You, Ben.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks for fighting the good fight.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, so we're going to continue on with our show here. We have much more to discuss. We had a bunch of stories we wanted to get through with Ben before he had to run, and I think that we've actually managed to accomplish that. Mike and Emery, if there's stuff that, you know, we had to kind of rush through that you want to go back to, we can certainly do that as well. We have another hour to spend with each other and working our way through the interesting stuff in our rundown. I wanted to take the opportunity here as we sort of take a breather. rushing through with Ben, to let folks know that the TWIT audience survey is still out there available for you to participate in. Let us know what you're liking about what we're doing here at TWIT. It's at twit.tv/survey. Let us know what you're not liking, too. Do the whole thing. You know, we want your feedback, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It should only take you about 2 minutes to finish. This survey will help us get a general idea of who our audience is, provide better programming, and it helps us pick advertisers we think you'd be interested in. Many of you take privacy very, very seriously, as we do here at This Week in Law. We promise that we're always going to protect that. We do not identify you in any way in the survey. Head on over to twit.tv/survey now and give us a hand if you can. Guys, what a great talk, huh?
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry for not having any good questions. I was just sort of shell-shocked. That's exactly the sort of topic that I originally tuned into the show. So I was caught in a little bit like, wow, let me just hear all these amazing questions and answers. So, yeah. Thank you, Ben, for joining us.
I felt like I was hogging all the air, and I knew you were chomping at the bit, Emery, and wanted to ask a million things.
It was more like, oh, my God, Denise is asking all their best questions. What am I going to say?
Well, good. We'll survey each other. I love our little mutual admiration society we're engaged in here. That's wonderful. And I'm just sort of at a loss. We have so much in the rundown. Where to go next?
There was one question I was hoping to get to ask Ben before he left when we were discussing the events that happened most recently at Berkeley. And I read the provost statement about why the university was still going to allow Yiannopoulos to visit campus. I thought it was really well written. I think, reasonable minds can probably disagree on it. But one thing that struck me is, the provost was saying, we need to – the cure for harmful speech or hateful speech is more speech and to contrasting point of views, and we're in the business of educating students and getting them to grow as human beings and so on and so forth. So I'm on board with all of that. It did strike me, though, that he'd also mentioned in the statement that, look, we've brought in police officials from various other counties, I believe. And mm-hmm. it does raise the question in my mind, at what point does a university, a government actor, at what point can they say, look, we don't want to subject our students to potential riots, potential harm that could be inflicted by others. So we're just not going to bring this controversial figure here because the secondary effects are just too potentially problematic for us. And we don't want to be in the business of having to, protect our students from these harmful effects. It strikes me as that's a pretty reasonable position for a university to take. And I just wanted to throw that out there to Emery and Denise to see what you thought.
Well, my gut take is that originally, the organization that brought this is not this, the school is not responsible for paying Yiannopoulos to come to speak. It was like a individual organization on campus. And, I agree with you. I think that the chancellor's statement on it was very eloquent. It's hard to disagree with, I think, the idea that, universities are bastions of free speech where you necessarily need places to have debate and spirited debate of views that you may find abhorrent. I think that maybe in adding a line in their charter that says that if you bring people on campus that instigate a riot, that affect your charter as an organization with the school, or that push the bill off onto the people that are responsible. But again, we're talking about like people responsible for this. I'm not sure how I feel about this past weekend because. As the reports that I read and the testimonies that I've heard have said that, place a lot of the blame of this on, a group of provocateurs that may not have even been part of the university, the so-called right. Black Bloc mm-hmm. that, is known for going to protests in San Francisco, dressing all in black so their faces are obscured, operating in apparently like paramilitary fashion to, instigate violence. It doesn't seem necessarily fair that you could even say that this is, the fault of the university or the fault of the students protesting at the university. And so I'd be worried about, putting requirements on, or I guess allowing universities to then shut down speech preemptively because of the fear that, you know, some other group may come out and not like what people on their school, on their campus are saying?
Yeah, I think it's a super tough question. I think that the chancellor made the right choice in deciding to allow the talk, but knowing how it had ramped up, you know, from the 15 protesters at UCI, and I think UCLA had a few more, and then we had someone get shot at a demonstration in Seattle, right, Mike?
Mm-hmm. Right, I believe when, that's right.
I think this was either on the day of or right after the inauguration.
Yeah.
The crowd was so, you know, churned up that somebody got shot. And I think it was kind of an accident. You know, I read the account of how it all unfolded. And, I don't think someone took aim and fired and meant to harm. But there was, you know, some sort of self-defense that was claimed. And the guy was okay. He was shot in the stomach and received care thankfully did not have, you know, I'm sure it's not fun to get shot in the stomach. Don't get me wrong. Right. Hopefully he's still with us. And, you know, knowing that all this was ramping up, I wish that the university, you know, had done more or had more of a proactive role with the police who they brought in and were enforcing. It did seem, I watched a lot of it unfold live, and it did seem like people were just sort of having at it, and the police were barking at them, but not doing a whole lot to make sure that things got under control, or at least, you know, it feels really strange to be sitting here saying, I wish the police had been more harsh with the protesters. but it did seem like there was a lot of riot and not enough riot control. And I far be it for me to step in and say how you control a riot. It's certainly not my area of expertise, but just from watching it unfold on TV, it seemed like things got out of hand really quickly. They were asked, the university was asked by many, many people on campus, don't allow this to happen. I think, you know, foreseeing that something like this could be the result, the LA Times reported that there was a letter from a dozen faculty members that argued his talk could be canceled on the grounds that his actions, which they called harassment, slander, defamation, and hate speech, violated UC Berkeley's code of conduct. There is no current law allowing funding to be stopped for alleged unwillingness to hear another's point of view. Oh, I'm moving into a different quote to a different point. The point of the presidential tweet and quote unquote withdraw federal funds ? But no, on the point of whether this was speech that they had to accommodate or not, I think that UC Berkeley probably had some cover there where they could have either said or kind of said both. We don't consider this protected speech. And we're worried about the violence and hence are going to shut it down. But they didn't do that. They allowed it to happen. I just think, you know, when you make that decision, and again, hindsight's 2020, that you have to make sure people stay safe. It seemed like a lot of those protesters were out there to peacefully make themselves heard and make folks aware that they didn't approve of the things that this speaker was anticipated to come on campus and say, and that you shouldn't be in the position of wanting to make that statement and then also all of a sudden be in danger of being, you know, perhaps no one was shot in Berkeley, but this kind of thing has happened at these kinds of demonstrations before. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I think it's a tough speech issue, and because of the way the First Amendment works, and the fact that it's a public university, I think the chancellor's hands were probably tied. You know, although they probably would have loved to not have it, not necessarily on a content basis, but on a safety basis.
Yeah,
I don't think they had much choice.
Of course, I mean, if we are looking at, you know, protests on a, you know, if we look at protests in a French setting or a European setting or in a, much of the world when, you know, protests happen, cars get set on fire and windows get broken. And, you know, that's like there. Yeah, I think that there is a point that we have to acknowledge that no one was shot and that, you know, this is sort of what is. It comes back again down to the campus policing issue. You know, when you have a lot of people, when you have, you know, very contentious issues, when you have people that may be specifically there to instigate violence in protests like this, they get out of hand. And, you know, property destruction is sort of exactly what happens in that situation. And I don't think that we need to be, you know, we see a fire that from, again, like, I think there are mixed reports about how the fire was originally started, though there are definitely videos of people feeding the fire with other things, but whatever. You know, it's really, really dangerous and worrisome, I think, to even be in having the idea, the discussion about whether or not we need to be removing funds from California university systems because they're, you know, stopping speech because there was a protest or there was, you know, property damage at a protest. Right. And again, you know, I don't think that's the case here, that there was anyone silenced.
We didn't get to go into it with Ben, but I have it in our discussion points for anyone who wants to read about the ACLU's representation, or not representation. I guess they filed an amicus brief in the case involving the Westboro Baptist Church, who were the people going around protesting at military funerals in a very outrageous, offensive, and unpopular way. And the ACLU jumped in there to say that those are the cases where the First Amendment's most important and where it's the most important to stand up for it. It was, here's a statement from Stephen Shapiro, the ACLU's legal director, in connection with that case. The First Amendment was designed to protect offensive and unpopular speech. It is in hard cases like this where our commitment to free speech is most tested and most important. Actually, that was from the blogger who wrote up that entry on the ACLU blog. What the legal director said was the First Amendment was really designed to protect a debate at the fringes. You don't need the courts to protect speech that everyone agrees with because that speech will be tolerated. You need a First Amendment to protect speech that people regard as intolerable or outrageous or offensive because that is when the majority will wield its power to censor or suppress. And we have a First Amendment to prevent the government from doing that. So, you know, I don't know that, again, I get back to, I'm pretty comfortable that the UC system is letting this guy come around and speak, and other colleges are too. Right. But, you know, you do have to be cognizant of the risks when you do that. What the Berklee College Republicans said, you know, in the aftermath when the event was canceled is free speech is dead. They, you know, declared free speech dead because the event resulted in a protest and cancellation of the speaker. And I don't know.
Our listeners can't see this, but my eyes are rolling out of my head, like behind my brain right now. It's straining the tendons behind my eye muscles.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not a problem that's going to go away. I feel like the temperature in the country is not being dialed down. I think that we're going to see more and more protest and you know, we have to find ways for that protest to remain peaceful.
You know, to bring it back to a technology focus, or, you know, I think that, Mike, when you brought up the chancellor's comment earlier, when your first point that, you know, the chancellor says that the way to combat hate speech like this is like mold, you know, the best way to combat it is sunlight and something else, sunlight and fresh air. The idea that we need more speech in order to combat this. I wonder if that generally agreed upon assumption is not necessarily as true as it is, as it used to be in the age of Twitter or in the age of social media networks and bubbles. Is it necessarily true that, you know, more and more and more discourse, we eventually reach at an agreement that these, you know, alt-right or, you know, whatever have you, the people that you disagree with on the internet are wrong? And I don't necessarily know if that's the truth. And what are the implications of that? You know, what are the implications of the idea that maybe it's not, maybe that doesn't actually change anything, is, you know, having a bunch of speech, having lots and lots of free speech zones. I don't know. I'm just throwing ideas different. Out here, but yeah,
I think it's it is different when you're on the internet and when you're hearing someone and interacting with someone in person. It's why, yeah. You know, internet trolling goes places where people would presumably and hopefully never go interacting with one another in person.
Well, so you know, it leads to bad things in real meat space. You know, I think that I want to preface this by saying I do not think you should go out and punch a Nazi if, you know, the Nazi that you're talking about is, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos necessarily, because I think that, you know, that is how to say this. It's what I am seeing on the Twitter sphere and on the internet response from many leftists, if you know that's what they would be called, is that, you know, all of this debate, all of this public discourse, all of your Twitter hashtags didn't stop Richard Spencer from, you know, going out and speaking, but one dude punching him at a, you know, at a public event did. And I'm not saying I support that, but I'm saying that maybe in these sort of echo chambers, internet, you know, technology induced echo chambers that we find ourselves in, is that the response? Is that what inevitably leads to, if in fact the solution to hate speech is not more speech, which is worrisome, but.
All right.
These are incredibly complex social and legal and political issues, I guess. I guess the one thing that, you know, it's a little bit disheartening to see so many people upset on one level. But on the plus side, we've seen so many protests over the last 7 days. Really since the inauguration. And, you know, for the most part, they've been, you know, very vocal, but still pretty peaceful events. So that's really encouraging to see that we can still protest and still have very serious disagreements. But at the end of the day, you know, we're not seeing massive riots break out in the streets. So that is obviously great news.
Right. And, you know, I think universities and other places will learn from what happened in Berkeley, and that when they see folks show up dressed in black and carrying shields and, you know, beginning to instigate what would otherwise be a peaceful crowd, I wonder if they could have done, or, you know, if this has its own speech ramifications, if they could have done some kind of crowd control where they were checking student IDs and making sure that the people there were not outside
checking their social media accounts and
getting the contacts off their phone. You know, I think in the name of safety, there were probably steps that could have been taken. But again, you know, I'm sure there would be speech arguments launched that, hey, you know, we showed up to protest this guy and the campus wouldn't allow us to attend. So tough issue, but one that I'm sure is not going away anytime soon, and we will continue to watch. What else did you guys want to talk about? You want to talk about the Supreme Court nominee?
Sure, we can talk about Gorsuch.
I must confess.
It's weird not having a bumper.
I know, no bumper. Like,
perfect.
Well, again, this is a good bumperless discussion because it comes up, you know, across a lot of our topics. James Grimmelrin has a great blog post talking about decisions that Judge Gorsuch has made over the years that have a copyright or technology overlay. And I really want to spend some time with this blog post, and I haven't done much of that yet, but I believe Emery has. Can you bring us up to speed?
I've definitely read through the cases on the blog post, and I've read through the blog post. If we want to dive into it in detail or go into the real legal weeds, maybe it'd be better to hold off on it. But suffice to say that, you know, I also want to preface this by saying that I haven't read all of Gorsuch's opinions, and I haven't read any of his opinions that aren't specifically dealing with, you know, Fourth Amendment or copyright stuff, but specifically in the copyright and in the Fourth Amendment sphere, you know, his opinions are well-reasoned, very well-articulated. They're enjoyable to read and sort of a throwback to Scalia. Specifically, he is – for example, in U.S. v. Carlos last year in the 10th Circuit, dissented in a case that had to deal with Fourth Amendment search, whether or not clear notice of no trespass signs all along your property, on your curtilage, revoked any kind of implied license that the police may have to do a knock and talk, which is when they come up and knock on your door and talk with you. And the courts have traditionally said that police officers basically have a carte blanche rule ability to go up and knock on your door and talk to you, because after all, everyone has that same implied license. The Girl Scout cookie salesman or sales girls, or the, you know, FedEx delivery guy. Gorsuch dissented against the majority opinion there and saying that, well, no, look, if you have no trespass signs all around your property, then that is about as clear of a revoke of any kind of implied license that could exist. And he pushed back against the idea that the government just sort of has this inalienable right to do these knock and talks. Now, James Grimmelman in his blog post pointed out the connections that this may have to computer searches, to, you know, the idea of a Fourth Amendment search, and what is a search under the Fourth Amendment, and whether there's an implied license, or if you can revoke any kind of implied license to search your computer, which I'm thinking that it also probably has implications with, you know, we start talking about cryptography and encryption and the use of encryption, whether that creates a sort of expectations of, you know, privacy. Another issue that Gorsuch, is it Gorsuch? Gorsuch?
Gorsuch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Gorsuch. Thank you.
Neil Gorsuch. Tenth Circuit judge.
Ruled favorably on, according to Grimmelman, is a case dealing with the copyrightability of wireframes that were then used to composite images for magazine prints and advertising. And so the idea is that you have this company that makes their product that they supply to the people that pay them are, you know, wireframe models of Toyota trucks, for example, that can very easily be, you know, skinned with the correct, most up-to-date, biggest, baddest version of whatever car they're selling. And the question is whether or not those models themselves are copyrightable. In an eminently readable opinion, I think Gorsuch basically says that, you know, he draws the line. He pushes back against what I think copyright maximalists would argue, and says that, you know, at a certain point, these sort of wireframe models, these, you know, digital recreations of real life items, lack the kind of original expression that would give them copyrightable, that would make them copyrightable, which I think is the right opinion, the right decision when we're talking about, for example, the copyrightability of virtual goods, of, you know, 3D scanned objects, of 3D printable objects, that without, you know, some form of original expression, intentional lighting or shading or placing, where the characteristics that the qualities that the court sat on or stuck to there, that you need to be able to, that they should not be copyrightable, that we should be able to share them and distribute them. And again,
Professor Grimmelman calls that one the best modern opinion on the copyrightability of digital models of already existing objects. So that's encouraging.
Emery, you mentioned the U.S. v. Carlos case or Carlos case. You know, by all accounts, Judge Gorsuch is really a masterful writer. And so I spent a little bit of time with that blog post, did read a couple of his opinions. And the dissent in the Carlos case is really interesting, really well written. I wanted to quote a little piece of what he stated. Definitely. Of course, he was in the dissent in that case, and he disagreed with the majority opinion that these no trespassing signs did not protect the property owner from the police coming up and knocking and talking, as you mentioned. And so he opines in his dissent that under the rationale of the majority, he states, quote, "A homeowner may post as many no trespassing signs as she wishes. She might add a wall or a medieval style moat too. Maybe razor wire and battlements and man traps besides. Even that isn't enough to revoke the state's right to enter." So, you know, if he writes like that in colorful prose, you know, it's going to be a real joy to read his legal opinions. regardless of whether you agree with his judicial philosophy or not. Because certainly,
which honestly is the most that we can hope for. You know, I think that that's always the as law students and lawyers, you know, we look for what is the most readable.
Right. Yeah. Nina Totenberg, you know, she covers the Supreme Court for NPR, and she mentioned last night that, you know, he's very much in the mold of Scalia, but his opinions aren't as biting, but certainly they're as witty and as well written. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how this nomination plays out.
Yeah.
BuzzFeed has a good piece on the key role in cell phone privacy this justice might play if confirmed.
You know, I think that's what I think that the U.S. v. Kailas decision can be extrapolated from, or his dissent can be extrapolated. You know, if you can revoke any kind of implied license by placing no trespass signs, then you would think that reasonably it would follow that you could revoke any kind of implied license to search your device by, you know, using strong cryptography or taking steps that, you know, purposefully, intentionally make clear, you know, your intent that the information on here is private. So interesting in the Fourth Amendment search context for the computers.
Right. And then Orrin Kerr at the Volok conspiracy a couple of years ago wrote up a case that I don't know if James Grimmelman got to. Is it one of them? No, it's a different one, called U.S. v. Denson. That involved arrest warrants and Doppler radar devices. And Kerr thought that the Tenth Circuit got it right. Even if there were technical limits on the Doppler device, the officer wouldn't be required to know them and carefully consider them in making a common sense judgment about reasonable suspicion. So he's definitely had his share of considering things like the grave Fourth Amendment issues raised by use of a Doppler radar device capable of detecting from outside the home the presence of human breathing and movement within. Oh, I remember this case when it came out in 2014. Definitely a kind of a creepy notion that police surveillance could do that. But good that the court recognize that the Fourth Amendment at least is implicated in that kind of technology.
Which I think, the average non-legal listener might be surprised to, like, might not understand why that is a good thing, that the fact that the Fourth Amendment is implicated at all, that it was a search at all, is a good thing, in fact. It means that there's, you know, yes. So.
Right. And then over at Wired, they have a good rundown of why they think the next justice of the Supreme Court needs to have a solid tech background, and they run down some cases there that may be heading the Supreme Court's way that emphasize how important a good background in technology and technology policy are going to be, including our favorite, the Lens versus Universal Music case.
Oh, yeah.
The dancing baby case.
Right.
What? Yes. I've never heard of this in my life. What are you talking about? The dancing baby.
Yes.
How have we not talked about that ad nauseum? I don't understand.
Exactly. I believe Mike's even blogged about it many times.
Yes. On more than two occasions, I'm sure.
Right. So I guess, I don't know. I mean, the short answer is we're still reading and learning about Judge Gorsuch, and as we do, we will continue to let you guys know what we think about his capabilities to help the court decide these tough technology and privacy questions,
which are not always as clearly delineated along, you know, quote unquote, party or partisan lines.
Right.
You know, when we're talking about, you know, copyrightability and IPs in particular, but also about Fourth Amendment searches, it definitely is much more of a, you know, you don't make safe bets based on red or blue. And yeah, judging solely by the opinions that I've read so far, dealing with areas of, you know, Fourth Amendment and IP, of course, it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, the guy's got serious academic chops. I mean, he's got his doctorate in philosophy from Oxford. He went to, I believe, Columbia for undergrad, or either Harvard or Yale for law school, which, by the way, all of the U.S. Supreme Court justices right now apparently either went to Harvard or Yale. So he's following nicely with that. But, you know, in terms of his experience deciding, you know, heavy duty IP cases, you know, Judge Gorsuch comes from the 10th Circuit. He was based in Denver. Of course, the 10th Circuit is that middle swath of the country that covers like Kansas and Colorado and Wyoming. You don't really see a lot of high profile IP disputes coming out of the 10th Circuit. You know, but that's neither here nor there, in my opinion, because, I mean, Gorsuch is clearly the type of jurist that's going to roll up his sleeves and understand it, and obviously has, you know, great mental faculties to understand and appreciate the significance of these types of cases, it seems. So
it comes down to like whether or not you know, and there were certainly lots to dislike about Scalia's opinions. At the end of the day, if you know, respect Ruth Bader Ginsburg or, you know, any of the other more liberally leaning justices, you had to at the end respect the fact that she saw a lot of value and saw, you know, Antonin Scalia as a, you know, wise, good friend. Right. And I think that, you know, that is the best of worlds is when the Supreme Court justices are that sort of well-respected, maybe a little more in the ivory tower than the rest of us,
right,
which is great.
You know, and one other point for the non-lawyers among us, which I think is always interesting and that non-lawyers find fascinating, is that a lot of times lawyers and judges that do have very significant ideological differences are very good close friends. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, very liberal justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, she and Antonin Scalia were great friends. You know, they would go to the opera together. They really appreciated and enjoyed each other and respected each other for their various perspectives on things. So, you know, I think it's going to be the same with Gorsuch. He's going to, you know, probably be, assuming he gets confirmed, he's going to be, you know, ideology-wise, he's going to be different from several of the justices, but that doesn't mean that they don't get along and won't certainly be good friends in the process, so.
Right. Yeah. And it sounds as though he might have ideological differences and be ideologically aligned with conservative values. That's certainly why he's being put forward. But he doesn't sound like an ideologue. You know, he sounds like someone who thinks long and hard about things and tries to come to the right decision. And that is definitely a great quality in a Supreme Court justice.
No question about it.
Yeah. Other thing that we got an inkling of this week, but it didn't come to fruition. Instead, there was a meeting and some press coverage and no executive order issued. In case you're wondering if the administration has, you know, held off on some of its executive orders, this is one it seems to have held off on, at least in the short term. Maybe we'll get it next week. But we were supposed to have a signed executive order, I think it was on Tuesday, on cybersecurity that they backed off on and decided to tinker with some more. Mm-hmm. A draft is out there if you're interested in reading it. I think the Washington Post and I believe TechCrunch have copies of it. Here's from CNN's coverage. The executive order on cybersecurity seeks to consolidate responsibility for protecting the government from hackers. Right now, every agency is in charge of defending itself. This has caused years of consternation for the White House and agencies like Homeland Security, as each agency has different IT practices and exerts jurisdiction over its own networks. But Trump intends to give ultimate responsibility for protecting the federal government's computers to the White House's Budget and Management Office, according to a senior administration official. That's not going to stop him from holding accountable for the cybersecurity of each individual office, the cabinet members who lead it up as well. He says that he wants them to all be accountable. There's been no reference in the draft to either Russia or election devices, voting devices.
Or encryption.
Or encryption, yeah. So
which was, yeah.
this seems like it could be an order that is in keeping with some of the campaign rhetoric that we saw about, we got to shut down this internet thing. It's too dangerous, but it doesn't seem like, that's where it's going. It's more, on a, making sure the virus checkers are working within the federal mm-hmm. government. And that can't be bad. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As far as the orders that we've seen, what we've seen right now is a draft. And I don't think that anyone has any clear information on whether or not which parts of that draft are going to be part of the final documents or what would be added or removed. As far as Trump EOs go that we've seen in the past week, I would say that this one seems a little more well-reasoned. There's certainly aspects of it that are, I think, concerning. But those are also sort of two sides of the same coin. When we're talking about, the first part of the draft of the executive order that we saw is essentially saying that we need a huge audit of all of our cyber infrastructure with our government, with all of our critical cyber infrastructure, I think is this specific term they use. And I'd have to pull up the order to see how they specifically define that. And they set a timetable of 60 days for that to happen, to be completed, which seems really ambitious. Security audits are hard. I would kind of like to see a longer timetable to confirm that we're not just getting the, fire hose approach mm-hmm. or drinking from a fire hose approach. But at the same time, that sort of audit is something that everyone in the industry, in the cybersecurity industry, has been calling for forever. Now, of course, they're going to want the people in the cybersecurity industry are going to call for increased funding for their industry and say that, we need audits like that. But I think that it's pretty undeniable that given, for example, that every single agency has different IT practices that are apparently not consolidated or consistent, given the, number of, given the Podesta leak, clearly there's a problem and we need some kind of pretty intensive, I think, audit. Other aspects of the order that were interesting talk about funding, or rather I think it's funding and also sort of setting strategy for getting cybersecurity and cyber offensive education resources into schools, which is interesting. You talked about the fact that as part of the order, it would sort of consolidate all of that responsibility for policing the cyber under the Pentagon and taking it away from DHS. Mm-hmm. So it's a little worrisome that the military is going to be so heavily involved in this. But on the other hand, that's sort of who you would expect to be able to be handling this. Are there risks with this? Absolutely. But it's also seems to be based in, at least in reasonableness.
Right. Mike, you mentioned leaks earlier, and I think it's worth mentioning that we're even able to look at this order. And I think the many of the executive orders that have been issued and signed have leaked in some form or another beforehand. Mm-hmm. It's just worth mentioning, if you're doing your cybersecurity audit, perhaps you've got to figure out why the leaks are happening, or maybe the public should be thinking about why the leaks are happening. Are these strategic leaks?
Have been a great thing for Ben to talk about. He, talked about frequently, I think, in past interviews about the fact that, when we talk about whistleblowing as a problem, we ignore the fact that the vast, vast, vast majority of whistleblowers are, in fact, higher level government officials that are never prosecuted, because those mm-hmm. leaks that we call whistleblowing are just leaks made for political causes or political interests, and are just not prosecuted. So, yeah, sorry, I wanted to throw that out there. I wish Ben could opine on that.
Yes, I hope we get him back on the show. He's just a wonderful speaker and smart guy. But as we mentioned, busy this week of all weeks. I we've got other stuff we could talk about, but I'm kind of missing a bumper. And we haven't put any passphrases in the show yet. Let's put Leaky White House as our first passphrase for the show. We'll try and get one more in before we wrap up here. And these are for folks who are listening to the show for continuing legal education or other professional education in their field. If you're a lawyer and you want some more information about that, go ahead and head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page, and we've got some information there for lawyers who want to apply in their jurisdiction in the United States. And yes, Victor, I think we could at least have our animal selfie bumper this show, if you could. Maybe I should have given you more warning. There we go.
I actually do like the idea of a weekly Trump executive order piece or something. So throw that out there.
Executive order of the week.
Yeah, that's. I mean, I'm just making a prediction here, but I think we're going to be talking about him for a while. So, listeners, all you creative people out there, maybe you could make some bumper music for us, and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, you were talking about a fire hose. I don't know if it could we. Pin it down to just one. I didn't pin us down to one animal selfie this week because I had a couple that I thought were worth mentioning. First is, you know, we've talked about PETA representing or purporting to represent animals' copyrights. Here's one that the ACLU may want to jump in on and mix it up on maybe animals' free speech rights if we could show. The protest puppy, Victor, is our first one. There we go. Little German Shepherd who's out on the march and not wearing black and with body armor, shields, etc. He's
I don't see him throwing any fireworks. He's a good boy.
He's a good boy. Good doggo. All right. So protest puppies, consider whether if animals can have copyrights, can they also have speech rights? I don't know. Maybe a law professor out there will throw that into one of their exams. For those of you who are fans of our animal selfies each week, I had to mention, someone mentioned to me on Twitter that there is a PBS miniseries going on right now. Every Wednesday from February 1st to March 1st on PBS, you should check your local listings for... It is called Spy in the Wild, and it is the creepiest thing. If you're watching some of the video, they have created... actual animals, cameras that are masquerading as animals, and they are planting them among various populations of animals to get video of them. So it is a whole animal selfie TV show that you're more than welcome to check out, I know, and I'm going to try to between now and March 1st.
We need some sort of procedurally generated art to come out of those animal selfie robots, and then we can really make a show about it.
Oh, yes, exactly. What if the animal selfie robots are not only taking pictures, but making music, for example, or drawing things while they're out there in the wild? We will see.
Denise, sorry. I don't know if we have time, but in the rundown today, you had the infringing cake piece that might be worth commenting on.
Yes, let's bring up the infringing cake that turned out to not be so infringing. And it has an interesting coda. This is the inauguration cake that was not only at the current inauguration of President Trump, but I guess was at one of the inaugurations of President Obama too, just 4 years ago. It's the same darn cake. And someone, you know, tried to point out that the entire cake had been plagiarized. An intrepid citizen journalist on Twitter showed side by side photos of them. The bakery that made the cake, however, surfaced and said that they actually were asked to replicate someone else's work. And it was the intrepid citizen journalist was actually the chef. The cake on the left is the one I made for President Obama's inauguration 4 years ago. The one on the right is Trump's. I didn't make it. So the bakery apparently was asked to do this, and profits were donated to a human rights campaign. They did wind up giving Duff Goldman, the maker of the original cake, credit. And he came out and decided to be a good sport about it, remembering a fantastic cake I made is awesome. And the chef that recreated it did a fantastic job. Group hug, y'all, he says. So he was not too disturbed. But it is funny that apparently he was not consulted and had to go take to Twitter to get to the bottom of why the cake he created appeared at not one inaugural ball, but two. Mike, did you have anything you wanted to add to this?
Well, you know, it raises an interesting copyright issue as to whether the original cake by Duff is subject to copyright protection.
Right.
You know, there's nothing in the copyright statute that says cake designs are protected, but, you know, it would fall probably within the definition of a sculptural work. Right. You know, it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression. There's certainly sufficient creativity there, and it's sitting, even though it doubles as something that people can consume.
And in fact, the remake
has sculptural qualities. So,
the supposed infringing one is a pure statue where there is no edible portion of it, or at least there's only a minute portion of it. So, like, even I think that's an interesting part of the analysis too, is that, okay, so assuming that the question of copyrightability for the first cake is in question because it is a piece of food, but also maybe a sculptural work, the second piece is certainly more of a sculptural work because it is almost entirely styrofoam and designed to look like something.
So the Trevor Noah has this cake now. Somebody took it from the inauguration. Yes, if you've been watching The Daily Show, you will see that Trevor Noah has been displaying the cake. Someone brought the cake to the show and gave it to The Daily Show. And they're taking suggestions of what they should do with the – it's a bit tired now. It's a bit beat up and kind of torn up.
Sure.
You see pieces of the styrofoam hanging out of it. But they're going to give the cake a good home. They just haven't decided what to do with it yet. So if you'd like to weigh in on that, I'm sure you can get in touch with The Daily Show.
Sorry, I just wanted to put one more thing out there. In the chat, we had someone that asked, you know, but who owns the recipe to the cake? And that's, interestingly enough, recipes are not copyrightable. So we do know that the recipe for this original cake instructing how to make it would not be copyrightable. Just to add another little interesting bit to the analysis. So
right. Good point.
Yes.
And one other thing, to the extent that Duff, the original chef, was a federal employee, there wouldn't be copyright protection associated with this anyway, because federal government employees that create works in the course and scope of their employment, there is no copyright protection in that.
Right.
But he is a private party, as I understand it, that was commissioned to create the original cake. So he owns copyright in his cake design.
I love it.
our second passphrase for the show is obviously copyright cake.
Of course.
So we've got both of those in. We do have a tip and a few resources for you. Our tip is from the ACLU. It is a video that is about protecting your digital privacy, expert cybersecurity advice. And I'm trying to remember, I believe it features Ben and one other, this one doesn't feature Ben. This is just an ACLU video on 5 easy ways to keep the government and hackers out of your private digital business. So there are steps you can take that will help. I was getting it confused with, if you're also interested, there is a video that Ben did with an IT guy at the ACLU. This little thing I featured was short and sweet, just a few minutes long. But Ben did like a half hour interview with an IT person at the ACLU about cybersecurity issues. And it's along the same lines, you know, things you can do to protect yourself and your communications. So I encourage you to check both of those out. with the tip being follow the ACLU's advice in protecting your digital privacy. And our resources of the week are along those lines. Our first resource is the Speech Privacy and Technology Project at the ACLU, which you might not until today have known existed. I have a link. It's too long to give out on air, but it is in our discussion points that will allow you to search the ACLU database for everything within the Speech Privacy and Technology Project. And there's a lot of good material there, lots of good resources and information. Another resource for you to check out, either if you're going to be in the area, it's something that's going to happen in person at K&L Gates in New York and Palo Alto. It's also available as a webinar, and this will be February 9th, 2017, from noon to 1:30. I'm not sure what time zone that is, but it is a series. It's the first in a series on sexual privacy as a fundamental right. Colette Vogel, a former host here with me and a frequent guest on This Week in Law, let me know about this. Her colleague, Erica Johnstone from Without My Consent, is one of the panelists, and interesting topic, and there's MCLE available for it as well. So if you're interested in the topic and getting a little credit, I encourage you on February 9th to check out that webinar or go in person if you're in New York or Palo Alto. And then finally, our final resource, every now and then we like to share entertainment with you that we think is relevant to the topics that we discuss here on the show. And this is something I stumbled across this week in doing a little research on whistleblowers and whistleblower law, and it's called National Bird. It's an independent film. I hadn't seen this before. I'm looking forward to seeing it, though. It follows the dramatic journey of three whistleblowers who are determined to break the silence around one of the most controversial current affairs issues of our time, the secret U.S. drone war. At the center of the film are three U.S. military veterans plagued by guilt over participating in the killing of faceless people in foreign countries. They decide to speak out publicly despite the possible consequences. Their stories take dramatic turns, leading one of the protagonists to Afghanistan, where she learns about a horrendous incident. But her journey also gives hope for peace and redemption. National Bird gives rare insight into the U.S. drone program through the eyes of veterans and survivors, connecting their stories as never seen before in a documentary. Its images haunt the audience and bring a faraway issue close to home. So National Bird looks like it's well worth checking out. And that is it on resources and tips and animal selfies and cakes and things. What a great show. So excited to have been able to be here with Mike and Emery, and particularly Ben Weisner. So great of him to spend the time and join us this week. I'm trying to remember who our guest is next week, Emery. Do you remember off the top of your head? I don't have my calendar open. Hold on. Sorry, I do that to you every time, don't I?
Yeah.
Hold on. Right? Yeah. Use browser loads more quickly. 24th.
Keith Lee.
No. Who is it?
No. Keith Lee.
We've got a Keith Lee next week. Yay. So I've got that to look forward to. Aaron Perzanowski coming up after that on the 17th. And then later on in February on the 24th, we'll have a dark week. And then on and on after that. So we hope that you'll come back and join us when we record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. You can tune in at twit.tv/live at either of those times, at that time, wherever you may be, to join us live and jump into chat with us if you'd like at irc.twit.tv. But don't worry if you can't make it, if it doesn't fit into your schedule, if you're out righting the wrongs of the world, we're certainly thrilled that you're doing that. And instead, just join us on your own time. Go to twit.tv/twill, and our entire archive of shows is there for you. And you can catch up and keep current and go back and see what we were talking about years ago that are still open issues today. I always think that's fascinating to go back and go, oh, my goodness, we talked about that 8 years ago and we're still talking about it now.
I mean, it was exactly the topics that we're talking about today that I was eagerly listening to 3.5-4 years ago. So yeah, before I came on the show, I got to law school.
That is so cool. What else should we tell you? We should tell you, we already told you about the Twit audience survey. Hopefully you guys will remember to do that. And of course, reach out to us directly with your comments about the show too. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Find us on Twitter. Give us a shout there. None of us have been permanently suspended yet. Knock wood.
I don't have this blue check mark either. So follow me so I can get some of that real, you know, Twitter karma or whatever.
Yes. Exactly. Follow us during the week. We tweet out things that are on our minds and as we get ready for the show. And we love to hear from you there to let us know what's on your minds. Folks you'd like us to speak with, invite on the show, topics you'd like us to cover, things you'd like to revisit in more detail, things we forgot to ask that you wanted to ask. Let us know. We love to hear from you either by email or social media. You can also find us on Facebook and Google Plus. The show has pages both those spots. And we just hope you'll reach out to us however you do. We love your feedback and contributions to the show. It really makes it worthwhile for us to hear from you and know what you're thinking. Let us know how we're doing and how we could do a better job for you. That's why we're here. We'll see you next week on This Week in Law. Thanks for joining us. Take care.